And welcome once again to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? I'm the former military officer, Ray Powell. That's the former diplomat, Jim Caruso. He's in Arizona. I'm in California. Jim, how are you today?
All good today, Ray. Looks like we have another of your Philippine friends on with us today. I'm looking forward to the discussion.
All right. Well, our Philippine friend today is the very worldly Richard Hedarian. When I say worldly, I mean he's just all over the world. He writes, he's a columnist, he writes for everybody, South China Morning Post, Straits Times, Nikkei Asia, all of that stuff. He is a podcast host, he is a very prominent TV personality. He does it all. And Richard, how are you?
Good morning, good morning. Mornings are not my best time, especially nowadays because I have to really catch up with all of the developments and write on them. But it's a pleasure to catch up with you guys, Ray. And Jim, I think I saw both of you guys in Stanford earlier this year, right? So it's good to finally have this proper conversation.
Well, of course, Richard, peek behind the curtain for all of our guests or all of our listeners. Richard and I had a dry run of this while I was in Manila last week. And because of some technical difficulties, we are doing a do-over. So speaking of do-overs, the president of the United States, future president of the United States, is getting a do-over. There's going to be a Trump 2.0. And Richard, why should the Philippines care about a Trump 2.0?
Well, unfortunately, we have no vote in the U.S. elections, but whatever happens in the U.S. obviously affects the rest of the world. You know, in my part of the world, our Singaporean friends, a lot of them wants to talk about, you know, this is the Asian century. You know, some of your folks, like Farid Zakariya, want to talk about the post-American century. But the reality is that this could still turn out as an American century or half-American century, given the centrality of the United States to the global economy and the international security architecture. But even more so to us in this part of the world. You know, I used to write books. My first book was on the Arab Spring, the Middle East. I used to pay a lot of attention to the old world, Middle East, Europe. But the reality is that over the past 10 years, our part of the world, East Asia and the Indo-Pacific, has become central. In fact, one of my books was on the Indo-Pacific region. So what happens in the U.S. affects us because U.S. is very much engaged in this direct competition with China. And we have a treaty alliance with the United States. We have millions of Philippine Americans. We have huge trade with you guys there in the United States. We have a treaty alliance. And we very much care how the Donald Trump administration in the coming years will conduct the second phase of its competition with China.
Well, Richard, we're waiting to see what Make America Great Again and America First means in the next iteration of the Trump administration. And what I'm wondering is if that means pulling back and let China rise. Because what we're hearing from some of your fellow ASEANs is the U.S. should stop trying to contain China, whatever contain means. Malaysia has criticized Philippines for your apparently over-aggressive pushback. Is this a change in the region as far as how they're viewing China and its aggressive attitudes? And do you think that might affect how Trump sees, well, if you guys aren't interested, why should I bother?
Great question. I mean, I think there is fluidity and heterogeneity on both sides. I mean, I'm just looking at the Trump administration. There are folks of many different stripes and persuasions. There just a while ago, I saw the news that Elon Musk had apparently conducted a meeting with the Iranian ambassador to the United Nations. We know that there are folks in Taiwan who are concerned about Elon Musk, you know, favoring a softer stance on Taiwan because of his investments in China. And then you have Waltz and Rubio and this Florida Miami boys who are known to be China hawks. So I think there are going to be many tendencies within the Trump 2.0 administration. Let's see which tendencies will prevail. I think there could be also a good cop, bad cop element to that. But as President Trump said himself, he wants to end wars, not start wars. But clearly, it wants to do it from a position of strength. Hence, the whole conversation about peace through strength, peace through strength. So I think we're going to see many iterations and tactical operationalization of this peace through strength tendency. And I'm not ruling out, as we saw in the Philippines and many places, the closest of allies could fall apart. I mean, as you know, in the Philippines, as we speak, there's a mini civil war between Duterte's and Marcos. So I won't rule out within the Republican Party or the Trump administration, there'll be some feisty moments later on. So having parked that, looking at the ASEAN region, this is also a very dynamic region. I mean, you can take a snapshot of Malaysia today and say, oh my goodness, these guys want China to take over, with Anwar saying all of these things against US and the West over the Gaza issue. And then if you rewind 2-3 years back, you look at Mahathir, his second iteration, not his first iteration. This was the person bashing China, saying China is trying to take advantage of that, speaking of debt trap, among other things. So it's a fluid picture here. Prabowo, for instance, right? Just the other day was cutting questionable deals with China, joint development agreement with South China Sea, in the South China Sea with China, very much like Rodrigo Duterte, and very much like in the case of the Philippines, you have the foreign minister in Indonesia pushing back, elites in Indonesia pushing back. So I won't be surprised Prabowo will do that correction. So in short, we don't have really steady, static points of view among some of the key members in ASEAN. Obviously, the situation is very different if you're Laos or Cambodia, who are very much within the Chinese orbit of influence, who are very much dependent on Chinese aid and their bilateral relationship with China. But as you move into archipelagic Southeast Asia, it's an extremely spontaneous, dynamic region. Indonesia, Singapore, Vietnam, Philippines. And speaking of the Philippines, my goodness, I mean, just look at the wild swings we have been having from one administration to the other. In fact, within administrations, Duterte of 2015, 16, 2016, 17, and 18 is very different from the Duterte in 2021, who criticized China and said, you don't do this to our friends, and who restored our bilateral relationship. So in short, I think we have to disabuse ourselves of this static snapshot understanding of ASEAN based on some more colorful statements that some of our ASEAN friends say on the record. And let's be honest, as an insider in ASEAN, I noticed that sometimes we want to tell something to our Western audience, and then when we're with our Chinese counterparts, we say different things. And among ourselves, we say different things. I mean, look at, for instance, the WikiLeaks, which I analyzed for a book project back in the past. Lee Kuan Yew, the great Singaporean statesman, openly told the Americans, give us options. We don't want to be just left with China. So that give us options instinct is absolutely there with all core members of ASEAN, from Vietnam to Philippines and Indonesia. We don't want to be part of the Chinese hegemonic circle. We don't want to be just their backyard. We have a great sense of ourselves and strategic autonomy. And lastly, obviously, the Philippines, we have territorial disputes. 90% of our people want us to take a strong stance. So my sense is, even if we have another Duterte in 2028, that person will have a hard time do what the first Duterte iteration was trying to pull off, although unsuccessfully, back in the day. So in that sense, there is fluidity on both sides, but I think the center of gravity is towards resisting, or at least pushing for some sort of strategic autonomy in this part of the world. And that will be our interface with the Trump administration when we deal with Rubio, when we deal with Waltz, when we deal with a lot of people in the United States who see China as a strategic competitor.
So, Richard, we talk about wild swings, and of course, you know, so right now the U.S., we are in the midst of our wild swings. And so you've had the opportunity to see a Trump 1.0. You've had an opportunity to see a Biden administration. And of course, before that, an Obama administration. What things, let's just sticking to Trump 1.0 and Biden, what things of Trump 1.0 were good for the Philippines? And what things from Biden were good for the Philippines? If you could take the perfect amalgamation of the best of both, what things worked best for the Philippines as far as U.S. policy?
Well, essentially from Nixon, or essentially Kissinger, all the way to the Obama administration, we saw this policy of strategic ambiguity, right? Now, that had its logic, because in the 70s, the Philippines was the little bully. We had a much more advanced military compared to our neighbors. We were pushing the envelope there. We built the first airstrip in the area by the late 1970s. So actually, Kissinger and the broader Nixon administration were worried that we drag the Americans into war, right? We're the little bully who will use our mutual defense treaty with the United States as a leash, essentially, or a whiplash, actually, rather, to push back against Vietnam, Malaysia, and not to mention China. So during the Nixon administration, there was this decision to make it clear that our mutual defense treaty is not going to be a pretext for the Philippines' territorial self-aggrandizement. In fact, that's exactly the term that Kissinger used in one of the cables. And that policy essentially would extend all the way to the Obama administration, except by the time Trump comes in, it's very clear to everyone that strategic ambiguity doesn't make sense. It's ambiguity without strategy. because America was never clear about the precise parameters of its mutual defense treaty with the Philippines. In 2012, there were many hoping that the Obama administration would make a much more strident intervention in the Scarborough case. In 1994, 1995, there was hope that the United States would do that. So there were multiple important incidents from Mischief Reef to the Scarborough where the Philippines felt abandoned. And President Obama was given a chance to clarify America's stance in 2014 when he came to the Philippines just after we signed the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement. And again, he was equivocating in that. He was dilly-dallying on that. And I made this very clear to our friends in Washington, D.C., that do not use the term bunch of rocks, because Obama said, we don't go to war over a bunch of rocks. And that was very offensive to a lot of us in the Philippines. And we felt not only he was not giving us clear assurances, he was quite dismissive towards that. So that is why when Trump comes in, and within years, you have Secretary Pompeo, although, of course, it took 2 or 3 years, by 2019, Secretary Pompeo is here in Manila and saying the Mutual Defense Treaty will apply if there is any attack on Philippine troops, vessels, and aircrafts in the South China Sea. So you cannot find any precedents from Nixon onwards whereby a Secretary of State publicly says that any attack on Philippines, essentially military assets, public assets, will automatically invoke the Mutual Defense Treaty in the South China Sea. The terminology was much more vague in the Pacific in the past. It was said much more in private. We had, at the level of ambassador, some statements being made. But this clarity was very much appreciated in the Philippines, not to mention when Trump pushed ahead with tariffs and much more strident rhetoric towards China. This was also interpreted as finally the United States is also recognizing and realizing the importance of this. Let me also say, from my personal perspective, I remember going to Washington, D.C. in early 2010s, and I felt back in the day we were not taken as seriously, maybe because I was just such a bunch of, I was just a bunch of kid, right? But we're also not taken seriously in the sense that when we talk about the Chinese threat and we emphasize the need for the arbitration case and why we need the rules-based order, I sense a lot of hesitation in Washington, D.C., because this was still the phase of engagement, right? Pivot to Asia, but still engagement. But I sense from 2017 onwards, you have increasingly this bipartisan consensus. So even when Trump stepped down, we were very confident, and I'm on the record on this, that there will be continuity in the China policy. And that's more or less what we saw. Now, obviously, tactically speaking, the Biden administration is much more multilateralist, softer rhetoric. But I think the direction of the wind has been more or less clear to us. So from Trump to Biden, we finally see the manifestation of this bipartisan consensus in Washington, D.C. on the need to do something about China. Now, that something is obviously a tactical question, too. And therefore, we're going to see many permutations and variations of that. So we're very happy with that. We're also very happy, not in terms of only clarification of the Mutual Defense Treaty. We're also very happy that at least there's a recognition, particularly among a lot of Republican strategists, O'Brien, Elbridge Colby, among other things, that Philippines is almost a frontline state. And as an almost frontline state, like the Poland of Asia next just to the Ukraine, which is Taiwan, supposedly, we have to get sufficient defense aid, right? O'Brien, for instance, talked about in his foreign affairs piece that, you know, the Philippines has to be supported similar to other key allies like Israel, for instance, right? And this sense within the Republican Party and potentially within the Trump administration that we're too much involved in Europe and Ukraine, we have to pivot to this part of the world. Those are music to the ears of many Filipino strategists. Therefore, don't be surprised that actually a lot of Filipinos were happy that Trump won. And this is a country where Trump had the highest approval rating, according to Pew survey, of 33 countries surveyed during his first term. And if I'm not mistaken, many Filipino Americans, including my relatives in some of the swing states there, are very much pro-Trump too. So this is probably one of the most pro-Trump, if not the most pro-Trump nations on earth. Now, are they being set up for disappointment? Maybe, maybe not. Let's see. But I think there's a lot of optimism that Trump 2.0 will bring more of the good in Trump 1.0 when it comes to the China question.
Well, it's an interesting question because we had Elbridge Colby on, and he talked about the importance of letting Ukraine be handled by the Europeans. Yeah. And it's a separate question to him about Asia. But now we're hearing more and more talk about a land for peace deal in Ukraine, right? And not just from the Americans, but from Europeans. But doesn't that translate into, well, maybe Philippines should give up some of its EEZ, so C for peace. How would that go down? Do you see that happening?
Well, obviously, there are folks in China who would want to argue along those lines that if ever Ukraine is forced to give up Donetsk or Luhansk and essentially accept, you know, Russia's annexation of Crimea, many will say, you know, the Chinese would say, see, we have a perfect template, right? Let's just avoid all of the war and the horrible things and let's go straight to the template. Guess what? There have been folks in this part of the world. Hugh White of the Australian National University, who has been making this argument forever, right? I remember from early 2000s, his argument is give up the first island chain to China and let it be. I think the person who has most eloquently made it clear that the two cases are not necessary parallels, I think is John Mersheimer. John Mersheimer has come under a lot of fire for essentially blaming NATO. NATO expansion for what's happening in Ukraine, and essentially the sense is that he's not very sympathetic to Ukraine's own quest for strategic autonomy. But if you look at John Mersheimer, when he talks about this part of the world, Asia, East Asia, he's very clear that America is not in a position to cut some sort of deal like that. China is such a humongous power that if it will to, you know, if you give them first island chain, what will stop them from making the second island chain a cushion for the first island chain? What will stop them from trying to dominate the Western Pacific? As we speak, China is building its strategic presence in the South Pacific, right? A scramble is going on. So this idea of a grand bargain, right? Just give them the first island chain and everything will be fine. First of all the fence sitters in this region will defect to China. They'll say, okay, US is the complete unreliable power. Let's just preempt it. Second, key allies from Philippines to Japan and South Korea, all of us will be jeopardized. And third, that will just whet the appetite of China to say we have to create an additional buffer. I mean, people who are familiar with Russian strategic history should ask themselves, how do you think China, how do you think Russia reached California, right? Because for every new sphere of influence, you need a new buffer. So there's just no way to, it's just hard to imagine a situation whereby you just say, let's give up first island and everything will be fine when the domino effect it will have in terms of fence sitters defecting, in terms of ally having second questions, some of us being fully compromised, I think it's just too unthinkable. Now, obviously, I know at the back of all our heads is, hey, we're talking about Donald Trump. He can do anything any moment. Yes, there's always that wild possibility. But I think that wild possibility can go also in the other direction. I deal a lot with our friends in China, and at least, you know, at the level of journalism and policy discussion, they're actually more worried with Donald Trump than the Biden administration, because he can swing in opposite directions. So again, we can slice this in many directions. My sense is with Putin and Russia, if we look at the three major revisionist powers, right? With Russia, I think, yes, there is much more possibility that we might move towards a grand bargain. With Iran, I think it's really a 50-50 situation for many reasons we can discuss separately. And then China, I think, is the wildest swing. It can go in either direction. So if you're Philippines, if you're Japan, if you're Australia, you want to talk more to the Marco Rubios. You want to emphasize, you know, the worst case scenarios. You want to do things to make Trump feel confident that he can hold the line while there's sufficient burden sharing. So this is where burden sharing comes in, right? One of the biggest sources of grievance for Republicans, a lot of Americans, is that the Europeans, who are extremely wealthy, which is true, are not doing their part. And I was in Berlin earlier this year. We met Chancellor Scholz. We had interesting discussions there comparing Asia and Europe. And I understand, even in Germany, they know that there's this disappointment with them, that they're wealthy countries. Germany is the third largest economy on earth. Is it doing sufficiently enough on the military front? Well, guess what? In our part of the world, Korea is already punching well above its weight. Japan, since Kishida and now with Ishiba, is saying that we will play our role. Australia is upping its game. And us in the Philippines, we don't have the same resources as some of our more wealthy, democratic U.S. allied neighbors. But we're now getting also invested in terms of missile defense systems. As we speak, there are conversations in the Philippines to acquire the MRC Typhoon missile systems, to get more HIMARS, to be more involved in the Taiwan question. So I think if all of us, the U.S. allies, make it clear to Trump that we're going to do the burden sharing properly here, that we're going to play our cards well, and we're going to, at the same time, not unnecessarily provoke China, that might be just good enough for the Waltz and Marco Rubio's inside to convince Trump not to cut a crazy deal, right? So that's my sense. Maybe on the economic front, there could be some grand bargain. But on the geopolitical front, I think the differences are just, the gulf is just too big. And the idea of a grand bargain, I think, is much, much, much more difficult to pull off than, say, in the case of Ukraine or even in the Middle East, from my standpoint.
So, Richard, you brought up the economic part. So, obviously, one of the things that comes into play when you talk about Donald Trump is his affinity for tariffs. And, of course, the Philippines does have a trade surplus with the United States. So let's play a little role play. Let's imagine that you're about to go to see President Marcos, and he is getting ready for his first trip to Washington, D.C., and is going to sit down with Donald Trump. And, you know, he's concerned. He's concerned that maybe, you know, the Trump tariffs may affect the Philippines. How would you advise President Marcos to make his case to Donald Trump for why that would not be a good idea?
Well, I mean, I think realistically we have to expect tariffs. I don't know the situation of Lighthizer, if he's going to really play as a trade representative as in the past. But I think the Lighthizer, Reagan to Trump 1.0, point of view, it has a lot of momentum behind it. I think even J.D. Vance, for instance, and some of these top Republican strategists we're all familiar with have this strong sense that something has to be done about this. Now, we know, again, logically speaking, I mean, just, you know, the newly crowned Nobel laureates like Acemoglu, among others, have come out and said the tariffs will be disaster for U.S., inflationary for U.S., disaster for us. Realistically, I think we have to accept tariffs are going to come. What we can do, not only in the Philippines, we have to coordinate it with our friends and allies to make sure that those tariffs, first of all, are much more concentrated on China and at the same time, not big enough to have a massive ripple effect. Ripple effect because we are integrated supply chains. All of us trade massively with China. So any recession in China, any major disruption in China will affect all of us. So it's a question of degrees. We're here essentially to damage control. But if I were Marcos Jr., forget about advising him. Let's say I were Marcos Jr. and go to Trump. My argument would be, well, first of all, I'll remind him of our great moments, friendship, you know, my mom and you, you know, Studio 54. Oh, by the way, I think we also bought one of your buildings. We don't want to talk about it nowadays. Of course, I'm going to bring all of those stuff up, Rob. And I think Marcos Jr. will have no problem schmoozing with Trump. I think they're perfectly made for each other. So putting that aside, once I'm done with that part, speaking of business, well, I will present the Philippines as a trusted partner for China de-risking, right? So Philippines is the second largest producer of nickel. And if you look at our production possibility frontier, we can go way beyond what we're producing right now to be much closer to, say, Indonesia. All the major nickel mines in the world, cobalt mines, anything that has to do with EV battery production is already dominated by Chinese companies. The Philippines is the last remaining gold mine for anything that is relevant to EV battery production. So I'll present the Philippines as a key trusted partner in this de-risking strategy. But more importantly, I have a piece with American Affairs there in Washington, D.C. We're also looking at this concept of co-development, whereby as the United States tries to onshore and friendshore some of the key industries like semiconductors, we want the Philippines to be part of that. We're just next to Taiwan. I come from Baguio City, where we have been building Texas Instruments, you know, for quite a long time. We have experience in semiconductors, not the highest end TSMC stuff being made in Taiwan, but we can be involved in packaging and design of some of the more high end semiconductors. Some of the Taiwanese producers can move up to Northern Philippines when the Marcos has come from, where the ETCA basis will be. So I think that will be the strategy. I'll be realistic that tariffs are coming. I'll be realistic that there will be no free trade agreements. Trump is going to also nix, by the way, he's going to nix even the IPEF, right? It's not even a trade agreement. So we're not going to have anything multilateral free trade. I'll just accept that, then push for this purely bilateral or actually trilateral or minilateral co-development strategy together with Japan, together with Australia. Australians have mining companies who can get involved in this. The Japanese are also interested in strategic investments in key industries. Already under the trilateral Japan-Philippine-US alliance, what I call JAFUS, right? So I think this will be the approach, a minilateral, bilateral, co-development, strategic investment-focused economic relationship. And then that's where we're going to tell to Trump, millions and millions, you know, we're going to make a lot of money together, right? And shake the hands and say, no China, we're going to build our own supply chain. So that would be my pitch. That would be my pitch, and say this is definitely, as the Chinese put it, win-win. US will win even bigger, right? Of course, we're going to emphasize that. So we are your trusted partner. We'll give you the precious metals. We'll help you with semiconductors. You don't have to be over-dependent on Taiwan. We can help in diversification. That's the way forward. So I think if you're Marcus Jr. right now, you won't feel as worried as some of our other allies and friends in this part of the world. That's why my argument is Manila was the most insouciant or nonchalant US ally as the map got red, right, in this US elections. Again, I know at the back of our head is like, poor Filipinos, so they're over-optimistic about this. Yes, we cannot control the worst possibilities, but we can push for the best possibilities, and I think this is the best possibilities. Forget about no tariff situation. Forget about free trade. Go for that co-development strategy.
I think Marcos should take Trump to a Jollibee. And I think once Trump chased that, he's all in. So you mentioned working with Australia and Japan, the other U.S. allies in the region, basically. And that makes perfect sense. But what's been bugging me, as Ray will tell you, is that your other allies or partners in the region is ASEAN. China is working to take territory from ASEAN. ASEAN is meant to magnify the power and influence of any individual ASEAN member. And yet, ASEAN has been, well, you tell me, has ASEAN been at all helpful in this effort? Can ASEAN do more? Is this a failure of Philippine diplomacy, or is it something else?
Oof. Okay, and now I'm going to get into trouble because Malaysia is taking over the ASEAN chair soon, and then we'll come afterwards. No, obviously, in my own little capacity, talking to senior officials here and in Malaysia, etc., my idea is that we're going to have ASEAN chairmanship back to back. So please, let's find the common ground here, right? Let's make sure that we're not like multiverses, right? Like Malaysia comes in, it's all about Gaza and bashing West, and then Philippines comes in, it's all about South China Sea and China and bashing China. We don't want that kind of situation. There has to be a coordination. So as we speak, there is a Troika conversation from Laos, which is the outgoing chairman, Malaysia and the Philippines. So I'm hoping our guys are doing their jobs. And probably I'm the last pro-ASEAN man in Manila. I'm telling you, I've been sitting in countless meetings of strategic thinkers with ambassador experts. I'm the only guy who bothers to say, oh, but what about ASEAN, right? What are we going to do? And you can see the look in these people like what about ASEAN, right? That's a problem. I absolutely agree. That's a problem. First of all, I think, I don't know if you had him, Bilhari Kosigan, our good friend from Singapore, he joked that the European Union is a Soviet Union with human rights, right? Meaning all the inefficiencies of Soviet Union, but with some emphasis. I said, well, I got a better metaphor for ASEAN. ASEAN is a small and medium enterprise without human rights, right? So if you look at ASEAN organization, it's almost pathetic in terms of its bureaucratic capacity, right? I mean, the European Union with hundreds of thousands of folks working there in Brussels, among others, with tens of billions of euros in budget, couldn't avoid the Brexit and all of the mess. ASEAN doesn't even have, you know, ASEAN's budget is a small, medium enterprise American company, right, with a few hundred workers. So when we say ASEAN, if we're referring to that organization that is supposed to agglomerate interests, there's no such thing. We don't have anything like that. So it's ASEAN is a great talking shop. I'd rather have a talking shop than what we have in the Middle East, which is a Game of Thrones, right? But the reality is that ASEAN has not come far enough. In fact, if you compare ASEAN to ECOWA in Africa, to Mercosur or UNASUR in Latin America, actually, ASEAN is overrated, in my opinion. ASEAN was quite effective back in the day when the big boys were there, Lee Kuan Yew, Sukarno, Suharto, Mahathir, even Marcos. They could coordinate. These big boys coordinated back in the day and made ASEAN very relevant during the Cold War period, defensively and even offensively on the Cambodia-Vietnam question. We can have a long conversation. But that's a bygone era. ASEAN now is led by a bunch of mediocre leaders, a lot of them strongmen, a lot of them very parochial. We don't have those great men who can bring the region together. And those great men, when they had their chance, did not build the strong institutions. So in short, I'm telling you, realistically, we shouldn't expect much from ASEAN when it comes to mediating great power competition. It's just not built for that. even more so mediating territorial dispute with a great power. It's just not made for that. So that so ASEAN organization...
Let me ask you then. ASEAN centrality. Go.
It's at best an aspiration, at worst a delusion, right? Again, I'm going to get myself banned next year in ASEAN. We have to do this, right? No, but I'm saying this, you know, in Espanol, like cariño brutal, right? This is tough love, right? I'm saying this because I love ASEAN and I'm very disappointed where it's going. So where does that leave us? Does that mean that ASEAN is useless? Well, some in the Philippines would say worse than useless because it enables China and amplifies China's voice rather than the Philippines. But having said that, I am a big believer in ASEAN minilateralism. I've been talking about this minilateralism for year after year, and only now everyone is, you know, using it. I've been writing about this since 2016, 17. Vietnam shares a lot with us in terms of threat perceptions of China. Now, is Vietnam going to have a treaty alliance with the Philippines? Obviously not. Is Vietnam going to go to war together with Philippines? Obviously not. But there's a lot we can do with Vietnam. Boundary demarcation. We can do our own mini code of conduct together. We can do more naval exercises and intelligence sharing. We can do more coordination of our diplomatic language. Guess what? Vietnam was the only country in ASEAN that more or less backed up our arbitration case against China because they saw their own national interests also in that. Indonesia. Prabowo is kind of like your mini Trump here, right? But if you look at the strategic elite in Jakarta, if you talk to the people who understand Indonesia's place in this world, and if you talk to Prabowo's ego, Indonesia's sense as a rising power, I don't think they want to be just a pushover and give up North Natuna Sea. Why did they have to rename the whole area as North Natuna Sea? Just as we had to rename our exclusive economic zone as West Philippine Sea. Because they sense the Chinese threat, right? So there's something there with Indonesia. And I think our good friends at IISS, even Laksamana, had this fantastic paper where he showed this is the number of joint exercises between Indonesia and US, and this is the one with China. It's not even comparable. So Indonesia, behind the scenes, is also conducting all of these exercises with you folks and other like-minded powers. And then Singapore. You know, again, Singapore has a lot of interdependence with China. There's the linguistic and cultural ties. But we also know that the Singaporeans are also very worried about China's United Front operations. The Singaporeans are very worried about the region getting into a kind of a conflict and conflagration. So why are the Singaporeans renewing American military access to Chang'e port for the next 20 years or so? They're doing that because they recognize the threat. Why are they buying billions in submarines and F-35 fighters from Germany and you guys? Because they recognize the threat. So actually, the only problem to me is really Malaysia. And my easy workaround for Malaysia is, Malaysia is Malaysia. I mean, like... One day, this guy, I mean, I thought Philippines is exciting. Then I go to Malaysia, it's even crazier. So I remember last year I was in Putrajaya, we had a meeting there, and Anwar had just returned from China, and he also raised the joint development agreement. And he was bashed 24/7 by guess who? Najib Razak's former buddies. So you had OMNU guys who back in the day were bashes of China, now bashing Anwar on being too nice to China. That's just how Malaysia works, politically in terms of rhetoric. But I think, again, I don't want to be over-optimistic about Malaysia, but behind the scenes, if you look at their naval cooperation with the United States, intelligence cooperation, things they tell the rest of us behind the scenes, it's very different from what we're hearing from Anwar. So I'm not saying ASEAN and Philippines are not having some moment of mutual alienation. But what I'm saying is that mutual alienation is exaggerated if you just look at the rhetoric. And second, the reality is that unlike the Philippines, all of these countries I mentioned, I'm not going to talk about Thailand, it's a long conversation, but all of these countries I mentioned, they have no treaty alliance with any superpower. So they have good reasons to be careful about what they say. And unlike the Philippines, they have much more economic dependence on China. We are a much more diversified economy in the Philippines than, say, Malaysia or Indonesia, who are very dependent on their commodity exports to China and investments from China. So there is a reason why that's we have this 50 shades of hedging, I call it, in Southeast Asia. But all of us are hedging nevertheless with different intensities. Now, going back to the very first question, what do you expect with Trump? One fear I have, and I use the word fear because I'm a patriot, I believe in strategic autonomy. My fear is that it's not that Trump will cut a deal with China and throw all of us under the bus, although, of course, that's always a possibility. But I think what's more probable is China telling the Philippines, okay, Malaysia, Indonesia, whatever, but you guys, you're my treaty ally. Stop this mumbo-jumbo hedging. You're with us or you're not with us. You're going to help on Taiwan or you're not going to help on Taiwan. Because if you look at the rhetoric of Marcos Jr., his talk at CSIS last year, some of the statements earlier, we keep on saying, no. You know, we keep on also being strategically ambiguous on the Taiwan issue. I think that will be much harder for us in the coming years. So what I think is more probable than a grand bargain with China is more pressure on the likes of the Philippines to essentially choose a side. And as you know, Jim and Ray, one thing we don't want to do in ASEAN is to choose a side. So my fear is the Philippines will be forced to choose a side in the coming years. And when I say choose a side, really like choose a side in the new Cold War, right? Not just the risking or the coupling. And that's the worry I have for the coming years.
I can tell you, Richard, that the in my experience with the Trump administration and ASEAN, that was exactly the message. You have to choose a side or forget it. And then, you know, Trump went away. We went back to more, we'll call it sophisticated or whatever you want to call it, the Biden administration understanding of Southeast Asia. But my impression is we're going to go back to an administration that says, I have no patience with you hedging and expecting us Americans to put our finger on the scale, and you keep hiding behind, you know, not saying anything to piss off your big trading partner. So this gets back to ASEAN's centrality, because no one knows what that means in Washington. It gets back to the concerns you've mentioned about the personal relationships that Trump will have. And if it's someone like Anwar, that's not going to go well. There's so many moving bits, I guess, is my question, for someone who works from the gut, as he likes to say. Is there any way to get Prabowo and Marcos and some of the others who have influence to come together and have a unified message that's clear and concise? You think it's doable?
I think it's very doable. I think if you're the diplomat here, Jim, you better know, you know this better than me. But I mean, as we speak, you know, Elon Musk is already doing his private diplomacy here. We will go and see more of this stuff. I won't be surprised, because you know Southeast Asia, right? We're a very celebrity-oriented culture, very like Latinos, right? You know, just look at how Prabowo was so giddy talking to Trump. Too giddy, probably, right? There is that side to our leaders, whether it's Marcos, whether it's Hun Sen, whether it's, you know, Anwar is the quirky one. Because I think the thing with Anwar is he's still acting like an activist, right? And he has this kind of a leader of the Islamic Ummah kind of thing. So I want to park Anwar for a bit. But Anwar is also an interesting personality. He's a very literary guy. So I don't know how Trump is going to, what books are there. Maybe they'll talk about his Art of the Deal. but with Prabowo, with Marcos, even with Hun Sen, I don't see any problem. I think Trump can really just have a Mar-a-Lago moment with them, with some of these key ASEAN countries. Obviously, probably there could be an ASEAN-US thing, but there could be a smaller breakout group where everybody, hey, guys, come on. Like, you can do better than this, right? Have this kind of a nice mafia New York, you know, moment and conversation with them. I think that's possible. It might sound like crazy, like we're watching Netflix, but this is Trump. And I think there's a lot of openness to that possibility in our part of the world. So I think the Chinese are already feeling that threat, that Trump's celebrity, the strength of his personality, U.S. continued power in this part of the world may give that room for that. So again, none of us can vouch for its success, but it's something worth doing and it's something that could work. In theory, I mean, all you have to do, Jim, is not to bring 10, 11 countries together, assuming East Timor joins next year. You just need Indonesia. Singaporeans are already on board, right? They just talk nicely and careful, right? So you have no problem with Singaporeans. Filipinos, no problem. It's really just Prabowo and a little bit getting Anwar on board and all. And Vietnam is obviously going to be more than happy. So if you look, you get those four or five countries together and schmooze them, Trump-wise, and then put their smart guys together to do the operational tactical side, something special can come out here. Because you're absolutely right. Biden was very nuanced, very multilateralist. But you know, Biden's emphasis on democratic values. I am a Democrat. I believe in democracy. You know, I've been fighting the Dutertismo for all this time. But I know also as a fact that, you know, all this Biden democracy summit, et cetera, was just annoying everyone, right? And Biden, just like Obama, was just creating a lot of expectation, right? I mean, look at how much deals Singaporeans and Vietnamese were hurt that they were not invited to the democracy summit. Next thing you know, Biden saying something that I'm not sure India or Philippines are really democracy. So at least all of that will go away. So in theory, Trump is not just the showman. He's not just a celebrity. His very transactionalist approach, I think, is more instinctively relatable to the leaders here, whether democratically elected like Prabowo and Marcos or not so democratically elected ones in some of the other countries. I think it's worth taking, and I think it could work with Vietnam. And so you have to just get these four or five countries to have a minimum basis. And Trump can even say, hey, you don't have to take my side per se, although I and Marcos will have a conversation later on. But four of you, just don't sound your pro-China, right? Just don't sound like Cambodia. Just don't say some of the things you're saying before. Create enough buffer, because at the end of the day, even you say you don't want to be our lackey, but I'm sure you don't want to also be China's lackey, right? So you also have to, I think that will work with Prabowo especially. Like Prabowo, you're Indonesia. You're a great nation. You're the fourth largest, this and that. You just want to be China's this? Come on, don't do that. You can do better than that. So my sense is that personal diplomacy could work if Trump can get his head wrapped around it. And then the operational side is done on the sides.
All right. So we have come up. We're coming up on time. So I want to give you a chance to get out of here on some lighter notes. You're a very experienced podcaster. We only have one podcast. You have three. So give us some advice. We're new to this. We've only been doing this since April. As an experienced podcaster with a lot of reach, what do you advise us to do going forward? What are some good techniques you've picked up along the way?
Beautiful, beautiful. Like, let's go to the show, man. Beautiful. I'm still thinking. I have a couple of other ones that are, well, I mean, I think you guys are doing very well. And by the way, congratulations, Ray and Jim. I'm really glad you're doing this. I mean, in fact, I think Ray just announced this like a few days after we had our podcast together. I was like, yes, finally, that's how we should do it.
I appeared on Rupert's podcast a little while ago, so
it did very well. In addition to our TV one. The thing is, first of all, you have to build momentum and branding with one, and then you can diversify. So it's the Elon Musk strategy, right? You build your PayPal, and then from there you get to Tesla and SpaceX and all of that. And next thing you know, all of them are feeding off on each other. So the term for that is the Da Vinci method, right? You focus on one and then you diversify, right? So you guys, I think, are building very strongly this one. The other thing I suggest is, remember, a lot of people don't have the attention span to sit through. I know the coffee was making me very vivacious and all of that, but a lot of people will still get bored after 5 to 10 minutes. So my suggestion is make also a lot of clips and reels and highlights to draw in a lot of people. From one interview, you can create 20 contents, especially an interview as, you know, I think I threw a lot of bombs and grenades a while ago. Like, you know, you can extract a lot of interesting stuff about like Prabowo, about Donald Trump, you know, and that's how you're going to build momentum, especially in YouTube, right? So my suggestion is our production team there, right? Make the most, don't just put like one video there and that's it. No. Chop it down. I learned a lot from Joe Rogan also, who has more influence on television channels in the United States, last time I checked. So he has clips, right? He has highlights. So that's definitely my suggestion. But you guys are doing all of the basics. And I think you're also doing the right thing, Ray and Jim, that you're mixing it up, right? Sometimes on Zoom, sometimes in person, sometimes a combination. And then I suggest that every few months or so have a kind of a panel discussion kind of thing. I know these things take budget and logistics, but that's how you build your brand. And once you clear a certain threshold, it has its own momentum. In my case, because I'm just a nobody, thankfully Spotify, for instance, took notice. So in the coming months, we hope that our Swedish friends will set up some of the things, bring the big podcasters together in Asia. So that's the line I'm going forward to. But as you said, Ray, we also have other podcasts. This is the present. This is not even the future. This is already the present. We saw how Joe Rogan single-handedly make Kamala look so unspontaneous, if I can put it that way. And Trump so young. I mean, you guys watched the 3-hour conversation. Trump, you look very vigorous in that interview. I was very impressed. So this is the future. Richard, so congrats to you, Ray and Gene.
We're not here. And more. Yeah, we're not here to give Joe Rogan airtime. We're here to talk about you. So tell us a little about your podcast and where people can keep up with you on social media.
How dare you insult my good friend? I'm just kidding. So I have one podcast with the European Parliament, folks. This is supported by European Parliament and ASEAN. So this is essentially middle powers, how to work together. So now is a perfect time with Trump coming in. That's called The Bridge with my good friend Zsuzsa, who's based in Taiwan, but originally from Hungary and European Union. That one, we're working on ASEAN Europe working together in this era of great power competition. I have my own podcast, Deep Dive, which you can find easily on Spotify, among other things. And then I have on my own television show and a couple of other things on the sites. So the other thing I suggest to you guys is also collaboration. People love it. When, you do interface, kind of like Marvel's Spider-Man versus, Batman. If there are other similar podcasts to you, especially those ones who are already established and all, work together. So if you guys are, let's say, West Coast, find your East Coast counterparts, East Coast versus West Coast kind of things. Or if you have counterparts in Asia, do an interface, because that way you can agglomerate your followers and you can build up your brands together. So definitely, I think the future is bright, Jim and Ray. Beautiful, beautiful.
All right. And on X, he is at Richard Hedarian, right?
I didn't give my Twitter, because that's my worst version. That's my Donald Trump version. I even use capital letters and all of that. So I also have different personalities on different platforms. So my least respectable one is my Twitter, but it's also my intellectual one. So
all right. Well, from the very intellectual, but apparently not very respectable Richard Hedarian, thank you, sir, for joining us. We really enjoyed this. It was a lot of fun. Well, Jim, that was fun.
If I could talk as fast and as eloquently and as long as he would, I would run for Congress.
You know, Richard tries to blame it on the coffee, but that really is him. I mean, that is all Richard. He is, whenever I'm with him, he has so much going on in that head. And you can see he knows a ton. I mean, he knows a ton, and he just wants to get it out there. And it's so I have a hard time keeping up with him. He's obviously a brilliant guy. And really, really insightful.
Well, I'm very pleased that there is optimism in Southeast Asia, at least in the Philippines, about Trump 2.0. Let's hope it's not misplaced.
Let's hope. I do think that my experience has been that Europeans and people who are sort of more westernized have the hardest time with Donald Trump. Somehow, the further you get away from sort of our Western culture, the easier it is for people to sort of adapt and say, okay, this is a personality. How do I deal with this personality? And I don't know why that is necessarily. Maybe they're just more pragmatic.
Well, I think they're used to strongmen rule. I think they're used to a certain amount of bombast from their political leaders. And I don't think they're as wedded to the niceties of political discourse that Western Europeans are. So that's my little theory. But you were just in the Philippines.
I was.
You just got back. You're at a conference in the South China Sea.
Yep.
Tell us, Ray, what did you learn and what did you impart? And if you don't mention, I'm going to mention the new phrase you coined that will have you banned from Beijing like Lady Chatterley's lover.
I'm not already. First of all, really, really well done conference. We've both been to our share of conferences, and sometimes they can just be really tiresome, affairs where you just listen to think tankers drone on about their latest, fascination. But this one was super interactive. It was very well set up by the organizers, a specific forum. So it's the first time they've done this Manila Dialogue on the South China Sea. And I think it was partly born out of sort of maybe some frustration from some people who had been attending events that where they didn't seem to really get anywhere. They didn't get to anything very actionable. So They did. They got great participation. We had three participants from China. Now, I will say that that those three held their own as best they could, but they were definitely not the, you know, they were on the short end of the tug of war. They, you know, most of the people were pulling against them. I did impart something. I had been kind of playing with this idea in my head, and it came out of some of the observations I was making recently on what I saw happening in the West Philippine Sea. And it's been growing on my mind for some time that, and this, you know, was a thing we could have asked Richard about, but the Philippines' problem in the South China Sea is actually quite different than the other claimant states or the other regional states, in that the Philippines has a major Chinese military base in the middle of its exclusive economic zone. This is Mischief Reef, which China seized back in the mid-90s and has since built into a major base. They have had their access to important features like Scarborough Shoal, a major fishing ground, which they lost in 2012, restricted. Their access to Second Thomas Shoal, where they have that rusty ship that's their military outpost, is essentially their access is largely controlled by China. So they can only get there now under an agreement a very tentative agreement that they've made with China. And of course, that was where we saw all of the excitement over the last couple of years with the rammings and the water cannons and all of that. And now Sabina Shoal is essentially under Chinese control, and this is much closer even to the coast of the Philippines than Second Thomas Shoal. So if I look at this and I look at the sheer number of Chinese ships now involved in controlling these major features. And then, of course, you've got Whitsun Reef and Iroquois Reef, where I see all of these Chinese ships all of the time. This is all within the Philippines' exclusive economic zone. And I think this doesn't really look like an incident or an incursion or the things that we're used to, or, you know, intrusive patrolling that we're used to talking about with other countries. This looks like an occupation. And so I said at this conference, during my panel session, that what I was observing was a maritime occupation by a hostile imperial power. And that definitely got a lot of attention.
Well, I look forward to the t-shirt and the mug. And when you say it got a lot of attention, was it supportive from all parties?
I will say I actually got a lot of support afterwards. You know, people would come up to me and they said, you know, I'd never thought of it that way, but actually that is a really helpful framing. And part of the reason is I think it helps. It's not just a rhetorical thing to throw in China's face. I think it's helpful from the Philippine perspective because it cages the problem. It frames the problem in a way that sort of gives you an idea of what it's going to take for the Philippines to counter this, right? When we were simply talking about an incident here or an incident there, it's you're playing whack-a-mole almost with these things. You're saying, okay, what are we going to do about this? We're going to lodge a diplomatic protest. We're going to figure out how to do the next resupply. We're going to take some more pictures with the assertive transparency. All of that's fine. But ultimately, if you're facing an occupying force, you have to look at a strategy of resistance, of almost insurgency. And I don't mean violent insurgency. I don't think that the Philippines is looking to start, you know, a war or you know, get involved in combat. But you have to think about what is it going to take using all the instruments of national power to raise the cost for the occupying force so that eventually they conclude that their best, it's not no longer in their national interest to push, you know, to push this occupation forward, but maybe even to start rolling it back, right? So you've seen this happen over the years with occupation forces in all kinds of situations where eventually the occupier concludes that this is just too costly. And why are we doing this? Why are we using all of these national resources to be in this other country, for example, when, you know, and in fact, I even pointed to maybe the one really good example of a nonviolent insurgency in our recent history, which is Mahatma Gandhi in India, right? Where essentially it was, you know, we came up with this term nonviolent direct action, where eventually they just outlasted the British will to remain in India. And so thinking in those terms, there's no perfect analogy. And in fact, I don't know if there is an analogy for a maritime occupation, you know, a nonviolent resistance to a maritime occupation. This is something of a unicorn. But I think we have to start looking at these lessons and see what can the Philippines do over the long term to change China's assessment of its interest and whether or not its interest lies in pushing forward even further with this occupation, or whether it would be better served to begin to pull back and, you know, and not be incurring all of the costs.
Well, this looks like the subject for yet another conference.
Absolutely.
And one more thing, though. Yeah. When you say there's an existing occupation that's seeking to expand its occupation,
yeah,
of a treaty ally of the United States, what is the expectation of a treaty ally in this, opposing that occupation?
Well, of course, you know, what we've seen when it comes to invoking the alliance, even in times of, not combat, but everything short of combat, right? You know, combat via water cannon and ramming, is that there is a hesitancy to invoke the alliance per se. So I think rather than talk about so much the mutual defense treaty and the armed attack provisions and those kinds of things, just sort of as the Philippines' primary security partner, what role can the U.S. play in helping the Philippines to be able to increase those costs? For example, if I look at all of these Chinese ships around all of these shoals, and I am going out there with one or two, or maybe on a good day, three ships to be able to sort of probe at Sabina Shoal or at Scarborough Shoal, that's not very hard for China to counter. Now, it still takes many more of their ships than, so one Philippine ship can occupy half a dozen or more Chinese ships. So, but what if the Philippines had three times that many? What if they had five times that many? And again, so they can keep China very, very busy if they have more vessels, if they had faster vessels, for example. If they, you know, what would you want if you were the resistance? You'd want to be able to strike. And when I say strike, I don't mean violently. I just sort of mean probing, constantly being everywhere, making China think all the time of where are you and where are you coming from? And, you know, just sort of stretching them out. On the transparency side, on the diplomatic side, on the, you know, all of these things, I think that, you know, would be really helpful to maybe just sort of think through and war game out and figure out how can we begin to build up a cost on China to make it not worth it.
Now, again, I think it's an interesting idea. I think there are many, many, many things to consider in how this might work, along with the pros and cons and dangers of it. Both for the Philippines and the U.S., as you said, the major security figure for the Philippines. But I think on that note, given your high dudgeon right now, maybe it's time for you to go to bed.
All right. I think I should. But before I do, let me give a shout out to our producer who has just received from our guest, Richard Hedarian, the mandate to make something like 20 clips of this conversation. And I put them out in little shorts. But in the meantime, he will be over at Ian Ellis Jones on X, where you can follow him. He can also follow us. We have an X account. Sorry, Elon. I know you're very busy with the Department of Government Efficiency now, but I don't want to get in trouble. So over on X, we have an account at IP Podcast. And then, of course, that's our YouTube account, at Indopac Podcast is X. And then we're also on LinkedIn. So just look for our Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific. There you'll find all of our other interviews, and I won't get into them today because we are over time. So thanks for joining us, and please join us again next time for Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific.